Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Almost 2 minutes past the hour, and here we go with Thorn in the Front Porch Thursday, a sort of hybridization of Thorn in the Side Thursday and Friday on the Front Porch, because there will be no Friday on the Front Porch since tomorrow is Independence Day. Remember, it's not the 4th of July. I mean, it is the 4th of July, but it's Independence Day, dadgummit. Hey, what are you doing for the 4th? Probably going to get a 5th. See? No. It's Independence Day. And while there will be much fun, and yay, verily, even I, yes, I, there are some wetted down hickory chunks that are smoking merrily away over a bed of nice, hot charcoal coals, and couple of slabs, well, ribs went on sale. You know, $1.89 a pound ain't bad. So there's a couple of slabs of ribs smoking away, and we'll sit down and devour them. We'll have, I think we're going to go do our holiday with the grandchildren. That's what you do when you become a grandparent. And I'm looking forward to it. And so, yeah, celebrate. Celebrate independence. But just remember, there's a hell of a lot that's gone into it. A whole lot. And if you're maybe working around the kitchen for your own Independence Day feast, maybe fire up Dr. Bill's podcasts from this week. They're easily accessible at whiterosesociety.org under the subdomain for his program. Take those podcasts and listen to it and get a little better understanding of where we hold these truths to be self-evident comes from. Because there's a received wisdom out there that Dr. Bill is convinced is incorrect, and it's not an honest mistake, it's not an unintentional mistake, it's a deliberate attempt to recast the philosophy behind the Declaration of Independence into something it wasn't and isn't. So grab the podcasts. Oh, hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. This here is The Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home, and this is where we gather from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, Monday through Friday, except when Friday happens to be Independence Day, and engage in a little cussing and discussing, as John Fox notes in the opening sequence. We will, like I said, combine Thorn in the Side Thursday and Friday on the Front Porch this evening, and we will hopefully get started on the Horn Malloy Skype chat group roundtable portion of the program, and maybe an hour or so, if you want to take part in it. Well, many of you already know how, but if you do not and have never tried it, it's awesome, good fun. And I encourage you, if you wish to join in on the roundtable conversation with people who are a hell of a lot more fun to talk to than any of the for-profit media roundtable people you're likely ever to see on the for-profit media, then send a contact request to Sparky Dunk, S-P-A-R-K-Y-D-U-N-C, Sparky Dunk, on Skype, and you too will be part of the group and of, in fact, the conversation. Now, a reminder, we spent some time last night trying to get a workaround on this. We haven't found it yet, but we're trying to make it so that we can have people call in on the phone line and get them involved in the roundtable conversation. But we haven't sorted that out yet, so we can't do it yet, and I apologize. eventually we will get telephone hybrid box fixed, and that'll solve all the problems. It just can't happen. It hasn't happened yet. So where are we? Oh, well, and then, of course, yeah, welcome to the chat room. Good group wandering in already. John and Jugapunch and Paul and Tim and Waggy and, of course, moderators Lottie and Sparky are already in the room with me there. And I encourage all of you, if you've never been to the chat room, check it out. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com/chatroom. It's free and it's easy. Of course, you can always reach the program via email, BobKincaid@gmail.com. You can reach me at Bob Kincaid on Facebook, Bob Kincaid Horn on Skype, and at Bob Kincaid on Twitter. You're free to just stand out on the back stoop and holler. I mean, that might work, but no, probably not. So, where are we? Well, we have spent the last 3 days talking about the abominable, miserable, disgusting, revolting, un-American Hobby Lobby decision, and with a couple of minor notes, I'm going to try to steer away from that because that horse has been beaten. But I will note before we run on. Did you know that as part of its employee health care plan, that Hobby Lobby used to provide Wahobby Lobby, Jesus Christ Superstore, Wahby Lobby, used to provide all the forms of contraception that it suddenly objects to? Mm-hmm. They just cruised along providing health care, and everything was just dandy, and they were providing the contraception that's covered within the Affordable Care Act. But then that one came along and got into our White House, and then he passed that Muslim Kenyan socialist usurping anti-colonialist deep-seated of hatred of white people Affordable Care Act. And suddenly Hobby Lobby realized that the jackboots of the federal government was right down there on top of their good God-fearing, upstanding, Bible-believing Christian necks. And suddenly they found their closely held religious beliefs and had to make sure that that they got rid of the really objectionable woman medicine. Really, and for true. So, there's that. Just remember, they're not just theocrats, they're hypocritical theocrats. What a nasty bunch. They never cease to amaze, do they? I just got something from Tim from L.A. It's a photo. He says he's going to put it on the Facebook page. Redneck word for today, Obama. I bought me a case of beer and drank it Obama self. Thank you, Tim. I needed a giggle. Oh, by the way, 9 minutes past the hour as we begin this Thorn in the Front Porch Thursday. And this is, of course, listener-supported radio. And that means we have an evening's fundraising goal every evening. We pulled up $70 short last night, so that would make tonight about $220. But everything's predicated on a five-day week, even when there's a holiday week that rolls around. So actually, in all truth, we're closer to $370 being the goal for this evening. If we can do that, that's fine. If we can at least catch up with last night, that's okay. If we can do last night and tonight, that'll be wonderful. So, think $370, 37 folks at $10 a piece, 10 people at $37 a piece. You can use either the PayPal button there at headonradionetwork.com, or you can use the traditional mail address, which is, in fact, located at the bottom of the contribute page and is easily accessed. With a gentle reminder that checks or money orders sent through the traditional mail service, the United States Postal Service, should be made payable to Head on Communications and not be made payable to Bob Kincaid. Because, well, Bob Kincaid never even sees it. Okay? And, golly, you know, I've been thinking so much since Monday and the Hobby Lobby decision. I've been thinking so much lately. Maybe it's time to become an S-corporation. I know, that's odious, isn't it? Maybe it's time to become an S-corporation, kind of like Hobby Lobby is. Closely held and all of that stuff. Isn't that phrase, closely held, just kind of creepy? Kind of reminds you of Brother Bill Gothard, the dear friend of the Green family of Hobby Lobby fame, who, it turns out, has a thing for teenage girls' feetses. Not fetuses, feetses. I'm sure he's worried about fetuses, too, but no, he like, you have lovely feet. Right. Creepy old. And I've been thinking about that and thinking about closely held religious beliefs, and as I mentioned last night, there are a couple of beautiful parody pieces out already, one of which says that the Supreme Court has decided that it's okay for Little Caesars to feed Christians to lions because it's a closely held, deeply held religious conviction. And the other one that says JCPenney can periodically sacrifice a pure virgin to their god, Cthulhu. And that's parody, that's satire, and it's funny. But I've gotten to thinking, wouldn't it be nice if there was a corporation out there that would develop the closely held religious belief that evangelical fundamentalists who do not believe in evolution should not have coverage for things like flu shots or pneumonia vaccines or chickenpox vaccines, or because, you know, they don't believe in it. These are all evolutionary biology-based solutions, and, well, they shouldn't have it. Then you have to, of course, balance that against the public policy need of not letting unvaccinated people start massive outbreaks of disease. And we already have that issue sort of developing in our little experiment in building a more perfect union. So, I don't know. Maybe that's just too mean-spirited. But I need, and, you know, it's not just vaccines, though. Anything that is based upon evolutionary biology, in other words, the entirety of medical science, should be unavailable to people who don't acknowledge the existence of, or the correctness, or the rightness, or the sanity, or even the elegance of the theory of evolution. What? Dick? Really, Dick Cheney? You want another heart? Okay, sign right here. Charles Darwin was right. The earth is not 6,000 years old. It was not created in 7 days. Okay, good. Right. No, okay, you signed. Very good. We're still not giving you another heart. The one you've got was too many. I mean, I remember, for instance, when Jerry Falwell was busy shuffling off this mortal coil. And lo and behold, he was taken to a hospital and given medical science based upon evolution. And I wondered why he wasn't just home praying it away. He probably didn't have anything that a good exercising, or maybe a bloodletting, or a leeching, or a flagellation, or it wouldn't have taken care of, now did he? But I'm not, okay, that's as far as I'm going. We're 15 minutes into the program, and we got other stuff to do. Darn it. Oh, we got a lot of stuff. Oodles, even. This being the thorn in the side half of the program, let's check in, where else? Texas! I mean, Texas, Alabama, Mississippi. Oh, there's There is a hot diggity story out of Mississippi. Hoo-wee! But let's start in Houston. KHOU Channel 11. Well, let's let KHOU Channel 11 just tell the darn story. That's what they're there for, right?
That ends in gunfire with a woman playing dead to survive.
Police say her husband shot her and her son before turning the gun on himself.
Our Drew Caritas is live in Northwest Houston unraveling some very sordid details. Drew?
Well, Greg, Lisa, police say this started as a fight over alcohol and ended with a man dead and both his wife and stepson shot in the head. Investigators are still piecing together the violent chain of events. We're told a man who had recently been released from jail first shot his wife after she confronted him over his drinking. She then reportedly played dead on the master bedroom floor. Police say her 30-year-old son went outside to call 911. We walk back into the house. He was shot by his stepdad. Detectives say it appears that the gunman then fatally shot himself. Neighbors say they heard loud screaming coming from the house on Fullerton Drive right before this happened. But there was often fighting going on amongst this family, so they didn't think much of it.
It's emotional because I've lived on the street for so long, but considering the people, not really. They are known for their activities, shall we say. I don't know how to put it, but it's just not been pleasant.
Because of the prior history with the conflict of the family and them arguing all the time, and that this could happen.
And just over an hour ago, a family member showed up here at the scene, understandably in tears, pleading for information from police. Police say mother and son who were shot are expected to survive. Police could not confirm a call history at this home or what this man had been in jail for. Neighbors tell us he just returned home this past Friday. Live in Northwest Houston, Drew Caritas, KHOU 11 News.
And our thanks to KHOU 11 for getting out there and bringing the story so that we can then share it with the world. Yeah, nothing says freedom like getting liquored up and getting out your gun. I mean, you've been sitting there in the stir for a while, and the most you can ever have is maybe a little rotten-ass jungle juice, fermented orange juice and grape juice and whatever else can be squirreled away in the concrete crack in the corner. And you get home, and you just want to sit down and get all liquored up and fondle your firearms because, wait a minute, what's he doing with a firearm? He was in jail. Well, maybe it wasn't a felony. Maybe it wasn't domestic violence. You know, because those two will take away your right to keep an armed bears. Oh, well. Wolverines. At least the woman and her son will survive. And no, I'm not going to queue up, I will survive. That's just a little too, no. Yeah. The gentleman's kind of a large gentleman, and he's always, you know what, I think after he's blown his brains out after shooting his wife and her 30-year-old son, we don't have to call him a gentleman anymore. And he's always been a very loud-voiced gentleman, and you could hear him yelling, calling for his dogs all the time. Even the dogs didn't want to be around him. Freedom! And from there to, well, why not? Florida Stan. Now, this is not a firearm story. This is just another day in Florida. Sorry, Florida residents, but, well, you know better than I do, right? The Sun Sentinel, a news publication in the Sunshine State. Get it? Sun Sentinel? Yeah. Which is out of, well, South Florida. Brett Clarkson with the report. We've got a long-distance dedication, and This is a story about a little rabbit named Bun Bun. No, really. Run, Bun Bun, run. See Bun Bun, run. James Wirtz and Dana Jongeward were a couple. Notice the past tense there. And James Wirtz apparently, and this story is dated July 1, so it's Tuesday, the day after a certain Supreme Court decision was handed down, a day after a lot of women got upset about the Supreme Court allowing people to, allowing corporations, you know, well, not all corporations, just one with deep religious convictions to shit all over women. Dana Jongeward were, James Wirtz were in an argument. It was about 20 minutes till midnight on Friday. Okay, no, the story's July 1st. This happened actually before the Wahhabi Lobby decision came out. It was Friday evening, about 20 to midnight, and they were arguing about women's rights. Now, it's 20 to midnight on Friday night. I am sure this was a sober, academic conversation, aren't you? No, me neither. They live in Boynton Beach. The argument started when James Wirtz said, "This here is a man's world." Uh-huh. Yep. You can almost see the toothpick extending from the corner of his mouth, can't you? "It's a man's world. Get me a beer, baby." And Ms. Jongeward decided that she just didn't want to participate anymore. So she did the smart thing and walked away from the conversation. Conversation. The argument. I told you this is the story of Bun Bun. Bun Bun and another animal by the name of Maxine are rabbits. Ms. Jongeward had pet rabbits. Lots of people do. Rabbits are fascinating animals. And they do make nice pets. So when she left the room to go to the bedroom to get away from James Wirtz, she heard some noises going on. And returned to the living room to find out that James Wirtz had picked up Bun Bun and was repeatedly punching her in the face. Yeah. I guess to prove it's a man's world, if you're a manly man, you have to beat up a 9-month-old rabbit. Maxine and Bun Bun weigh about a pound and a half each. And they had the run of the house. And they would follow follow Dana to the kitchen when she was cooking and just follow, because, you know, they were pets. And she came back into the living room and found James Wirtz punching Bun Bun in the face and choking Bun Bun. When he saw that she had seen, he dropped Bun Bun and started to apologize. No, really. And when terrified, rabbits can make unhappy noises, and one of the rabbits started screaming when James Wirtz, to prove it's a man's world, began punching the rabbit in the face. Anybody want to guess which way this guy votes? Jesus, this guy sounds like he could be a member of the Huckabee family. She said it was shocking, the most horrible thing I could walk out of the bedroom to see. That's when she picked up the rabbits to try to protect the rabbits against the man who was being manly in a man's world. And he grabbed her and threw her across the room and then left. Police didn't find him till Saturday this past and promptly arrested him. I'm happy to report that the rabbits are still alive, and so is Ms. Jonga Ward. She said, I just can't believe it happened. It's just disgusting. Both rabbits are being treated. They were treated by an emergency veterinarian, and they are recovering under painkillers and anti-inflammatories. What do you say? I mean, sweet little bunny rabbits whose favorite treats were marshmallows, for God's sakes.
I'll show her. This here's a man's world, and a man can beat up a bunny rabbit.
This is one of those moments when you wish Bugs was real, because the next frame would show him saying, you realize, of course, this means war. And the next thing you know, a piano or a 5,000-pound weight would be landing on James Wardson.
I'm feeling mighty low.
He's been charged, James Wardson has, with cruelty to animals and domestic battery. As of the writing of the story on July the 1st, he was still in the Palm Beach County Jail in lieu of $3,000 bail. Interesting that they did not give him a personal recognizance bond. Wonder if he's got any guns. By the way, that's one of the things that the NRA is upset about these days. The NRA is outraged, I tell you, outraged, over the fact that that men, usually men, who are charged with domestic violence have to give up their freedom protectors. And I'm sure that will... has it been to the Supreme Court yet? I'm guessing not if the NRA is cranking up its outrage machine. Jeebus. No, the NRA really does believe that convicted felons and domestic violence, people charged with domestic violence, should not have to give up their firearms. Because the Second Amendment is an absolute. And just because you engaged in a little bit of domestic violence is no reason that you shouldn't be able to protect freedom. Wolverines! Right? That's okay. We got lots of these. Lots of queens. Lots and lots of... No. And don't think that just because we started in Texas and rolled over to Florida that freedom protecting doesn't happen in blue states. This is the story of Cameron Waith, 54 years old, in New York. And he walked into the C&A Ironworks in Brooklyn about 11 a.m. this past Monday. And he asked Oscar Ramirez for a job. Oscar was not the boss. Oscar Ramirez looked at Cameron Waith and said, go talk to the manager. So
Cameron Waith then went to Joselo Gonzalez, who was the manager, and asked for a job. And Joselo Gonzalez said to Cameron Waith, go on upstairs and talk to the owner of the company. Meanwhile, Cameron Waith keeps looking around and looking behind him like somebody's after him. And then he pulled out his Freedom Protector and suddenly transitioned from being a lawful gun owner to an awful gun owner and took aim at Oscar Ramirez, who didn't have the power to hire the guy in the first place. Oscar Ramirez says, hey, what's happening? And those were the last words of Oscar Ramirez, because Cameron Waith then protected Freedom by blowing Oscar Ramirez away. No. Yeah. And that's when other employees began running and screaming, everyone get out, get out. Oscar Ramirez did manage to get out of the building. He was gut shot. 66-year-old Armando Tapia also was shot. And for an hour after that, Cameron Waith barricaded himself in an office holding a gun to his head. That's when the NYPD showed up and began negotiations. At which point, Waith said he would give up his car keys and something they described as a bomb-like device. And the NYPD negotiator said he thought they were having some positive negotiations. And then all of a sudden, Cameron Waith takes his Freedom Protector and shoots himself. Last report, he was in critical condition. Tapia was in stable condition. Asked about the whole affair, his mama said, I don't know what drove him to this. It hasn't sunk in yet. I don't know how I feel. My son is dead. Yeah, it was Ramirez who was, the two people he shot, one's in critical, one's in stable condition. The Freedom Protector is dead. He had a rap sheet for assault, which is a misdemeanor, criminal possession of marijuana, which is a misdemeanor, and resisting arrest, Cameron Waith did, all of which are misdemeanors, which meant that he was, in fact, a lawful gun owner, who then became an awful gun owner. Because we cannot impede gun owners from doing whatever it is they want to do with their guns. Sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. One day he's a good guy with the gun, the next day he's a bad guy with the gun. And there's really no way of knowing when, how, or if that's going to happen. We just have to put up with it. Because if Cameron Waith can't have a handgun, well, how's he ever going to protect his family when the jackbooted thugs of the federal government come and put their jackboots down on his throat and destroy freedom for him? That's just three stories. Well, okay, Bun Bun just got beat up, didn't get shot. Lord God. Yeah, this, it's Thorn in the Front Porch Thursday, right? Then, Tim from L.A., wanting to make sure that that we cover all our bases. You've followed the horrifying story of the man who is charged with murder in roasting his little son, oh God, to death inside a hot car. Well, it turns out that according to the investigators, Justin Harris, the father who roasted his son alive, allegedly, at the same time that his son was dying, was sending pornographic images of himself to a number of women, including a 17-year-old girl. He had been exchanging nude photos with up to 6 women while he was at work the day the child died. I can't even stand the details of that story. And Kim from New York just sent in a story. The Supreme Court. It's from the Times, the New York Times. Headline: Supreme Court order suspends contraception rule for Christian college. The Supreme Court sided Thursday with religiously affiliated nonprofit groups in a clash between religious freedom and women's rights in the story by Adam Liptak. The decision temporarily bars the government from enforcing against a Christian college part of the regulations that provide contraception coverage under the Affordable Care Act. The order was brief, provisional, and unsigned. But Justices Sotomayor, Ginsburg, and Elena Kagan were infuriated. They noted that the court has betrayed a promise it made on Monday in Hobby Lobby, which involved for-profit corporations. Justice Sotomayor dissented. She said, "Those who are bound by our decisions usually believe they can take us at our words. Not so today. This is regarding Wheaton College in Illinois. Non-profit, of course. And look, suddenly Hobby Lobby has become not so narrow anymore. In point of fact, not only this, but some of the president's own allies, President Obama's own allies, have since circulated a letter. Yep. You're going to love this, because you just can't beat a narrow decision. The story comes from the Atlantic. Damn it, I said I wasn't going to go back down the Hobby Lobby rat hole. And here I am. Here we are. Where are we going, and why are we in this handbasket? Molly Ball has the story at the Atlantic. This week in the Hobby Lobby case, the Supreme Court ruled that a religious employer could not be required to provide employees, yada, yada, yada. We know that part. We don't know this part. The narrowness is wearing off. A group of faith leaders is urging the Obama administration to include a religious exemption in a forthcoming LGBT anti-discrimination case. Ha-ha! There we are! Were you listening to Malloy last night? Because I was. Did you notice when Malloy said, you know, it won't be long. It won't be long at all. Before somebody comes along and says, oh, Mr. President, we need an exemption, too. Yeah, I heard that part. Pretty sure you did, too. It's already happened. So, not-for-profit colleges just got a pass. original sin-bearing women people. Yep. And now we want to unnarrow the decision so that it's not just about the women people. Now it's going to be about the LGBT people. And again, these are the president's own allies. Here, let's read their letter. I generally don't like to read other people's mail, but this one's been made public, so I have a feeling they want it to get read anyway. Dear Mr. President, as religious and civic leaders who seek to advance the common good, we write to urge you to include a religious exemption in your planned executive order addressing federal contractors and LGBT employment policy. See how I almost said contraceptives? Oof. We have great appreciation for your commitment to human dignity and justice, and we share those values with you. With respect to the proposed executive order, because since Congress won't do anything, the president is going to act by executive order to make sure that won't discriminate, because every time we expand rights, every time we contract and hopefully someday eliminate the ability of corporations, contractors, and the like to discriminate against people based on things those people have no control over whatsoever, like race, or which is of course a construct, or sexuality, or gender preference, or because we've already got it in there for race and creed, religion, that kind of. Well, we're going to expand it to include LGBT status. And remember, the faith leaders are telling President Not Sure right off the bat that, by golly, they're working for the common good, us commoners, right? You know it.
We have great appreciation for your commitment to human dignity and justice, and we share those values with you. With respect to the proposed executive order, we agree that banning discrimination is a good thing. We believe that all persons are created in the divine image of the Creator, and here they go believing again, and are worthy of respect and love without exception.
Remember, hate the sin, love the sinner? Yeah, this is that.
Even so.
See, you knew there was going to be an even so or a but or something there.
It still may not be possible for all sides to reach a consensus on every issue. That is why we are asking that an extension of protection for one group not come at the expense of faith communities whose religious identity and beliefs motivate them to serve those in need. Americans have always disagreed on important issues, but now our ability to live with our diversity is part of what makes this country great, and it continues to be essential even in the 21st century. This ability is essential in light of our national conversation on political and cultural issues related to sexuality. We have and will continue to communicate on these broader issues to our congregations, our policymakers, and our nation. But we focus here on the importance of religious exemption in your planned executive order, disqualifying organizations that do not hire LGBT Americans from receiving federal contracts. This religious exemption would be comparable to what was included in the Senate version of the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, which passed the Senate with a strong bipartisan vote.
And died in the House.
Without a robust religious exemption, like the provisions in the Senate-passed ENDA, this expansion of hiring rights will come at an unreasonable cost to the common good, national unity, and religious freedom. When you announced the White House Office of Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships, you said the following. The particular faith that motivates each of us can promote a greater good for all of us. Instead of drawing us apart, our varied beliefs can bring us together to feed the hungry and comfort the afflicted, to make peace where there is strife and rebuild what was broken, to lift up those who have fallen on hard times. We could not agree with you more. Our identity as individuals is based first and foremost in our faith, and religious beliefs are at the foundation of some of America's greatest charities and service organizations that do incredible good for our nation and for the world. In fact, serving the common good is one of the highest expressions of one's religious liberty outside of worship. The hiring policies of these organizations, Christian, Jewish, Muslim, and others, extend from their religious beliefs and values, the same values that motivate them to serve their neighbors in the first place. Often in American history, and indeed in partnership with your administration, government and religious organizations have worked together to better serve the nation. An executive order that does not include a religious exemption will significantly and substantively hamper the work of some religious organizations that are best equipped to serve in common purpose with the federal government. In a concrete way, religious organizations will lose financial funding that allows them to serve others in the national interest due to their organizational identity. When the capacity of religious organizations is limited, the common good suffers. So it takes them a page and a half to get down to the nut of the problem. Please, please, please let us keep discriminating against people based on how they love each other so that we can keep getting government contracts from taxpayers, because if we don't, we'll have to find honest work. Please let us keep being bigots. Please let us keep manifesting our prejudice. Please let us keep hiding behind the skirts of the First Amendment so that we can go on hating. Because we really like the government money. We really, really do like getting the taxpayer dollars from we the people of the United States out there trying to form that more perfect union. We really, really do. But we really have to keep on hating people. I'm talking about reparative therapy. And how Jesus wants everybody to be straight, 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 straight. Isn't that just delightful? Our concern about an executive order without a religious exemption is about more than the direct financial impact on religious organizations. No, it's not. While the nation has undergone incredible social and legal change over the last decade, we still live in a nation with different beliefs about sexuality. Well, maybe people should stop having beliefs about sexuality. Just like people should stop having beliefs about contraception. These are not open to debate. They do what they do. They are science-based, not belief-based. You see, there's an underlying danger here. And that is, and see, this is how theocracies happen. Theocracies happen when people's beliefs, in other words, their imaginations, are allowed to trump the scientific method. They don't know that their God doesn't approve of gay people. They believe it. They don't know that their God is just going to boot all the LGBT people into hell. They believe it. And they believe it not because they've had conversations with their imaginary God, but because the hate that motivates them lives inside their own infernal, rotten, pustulant beings. We must find a way to respect diversity of opinion on this issue in a way that respects the dignity of all parties to the best of our ability. There is no perfect solution that will make all parties completely happy. In other words, we're going to be miserable if we don't get the federal contract money, and we think it is better if we make
gay people be the miserable people, if the LGBTQQQ community is the one out there suffering. Not us, because God loves us. Hi, John Calvin.
As we know, you understand, a religious exemption in this executive order would not guarantee that religious organizations would receive contracts. Instead, a religious exemption would simply maintain that religious organizations will not be automatically disqualified or disadvantaged in obtaining contracts because of their religious beliefs.
Jesus, God, I can't wait until Boeing and Rockwell and Anodyne Systems or what the fuck ever, or any of these defense guys. I can't wait until they file and say, well, wait a minute. I mean, granted, we make stuff that blows people into molecules, but God is love. Can we discriminate too? I'm just going to laugh my happy little ass off when that happens. Yeah, we're really running out of narrowness here, aren't we? I mean, we are fresh plum out of narrow. Sammy Bad Breath, Justice Sammy Bad Breath, done wore out all his narrow on Monday, didn't he? And now it's broad like the road to hell. It's broad like Plessy got broad. Oh, this is only a case about railroad cars and whether brown people and good God-fearing, upstanding, Bible-believing white people can ride together on the same railroad car. It's a narrow holding. And the next day, Jim Crow laws and segregation laws pop up like toadstools after a spring rain all over the South. And, well, son of a bitch, what happened to all the narrowness? There you go. You see, you got a nice, narrow decision, and then somebody comes along and gets it all broaded up. Damn broads.
Mr. President, during your first presidential campaign, you were asked your views on same-sex marriage. You responded, I believe that marriage is the union between a man and a woman. Now, for me as a Christian, it is also a sacred union. God's in the mix. I am not somebody who promotes same-sex marriage.
God's in the mix. You know, with the monosodium glutamate and the baking powder and the calcium diphosphate to prevent caking. Yeah, sure, he's in the mix. And just add a sprinkle of God. And look at the Christian muffins you get.
You justified withholding your support for same-sex marriage, at least in part, by appealing to your Christian faith. But we all know you're Muslim. And even if you're a Christian, you were the wrong kind of Christian because you were listening to that Jeremiah Wright. Yet you still believed you could serve your country, all Americans, as president. See, there's that believing again. Similarly, some faith-based organizations' religious identity requires that their employees share that identity. We still believe those organizations can serve their country, all Americans, in partnership with their government and as welcome members of the American family. This is part of what has been so powerful about religious liberty in our nation's history.
Jesus, they didn't send him a letter, they sent him a sermon. Page 3.
Historically, we have been reticent as a nation to use the authority of government to bless some religious identities and ostracize others, but we really would like it if you would do that.
I mean, you know, maybe it's time for the Unitarian Universalists to really step up their game. What he's talking about, you know, under the cover of all of this sappy, soppy, kumbaya BS, is he's talking about like Catholic charities that feed people and things like that, but would really like to make sure that they don't have to hire no homos. Do we have any non-discriminatory religions out there that could step into this breach and let the discriminators and the bigots and the homophobes and the misogynists go and do whatever they're going to do, but do it without federal money? How about the United Churches of Christ? Could they step in? Or, and I know this is completely crazy, could we stop giving taxpayer dollars to churches? I mean, that's insult on injury, isn't it? We give them welfare in the first place because we don't make them pay taxes. And then, which means, of course, that we are subsidizing them with taxpayer money in the first place. And then, having done that, we turn around and give them taxpayer money outright. Can we not have any religion-neutral stuff? Does everything have to have God in the mix? We live in a blessed nation, constantly perfecting its fundamental ideal that no matter what God you pray to, what you look like, or who you are, there's a place in this nation for you if you seek to serve your fellow Americans. Even if you want to discriminate against people for how they love each other, there's a place for you in America. Yeah, it's called the Klan! Religious organizations, because of their religious faith, have served their nation well for centuries. They haven't been getting federal dollars for centuries. Let's be honest here. Oh, wait, I'm talking about religious people. We can't talk about honesty. As you have acknowledged and supported time and time again, we hope that religious organizations can continue to do so on equal footing with others in the future. A religious exemption in your executive order on LGBT employment rights would allow for this, balancing the government's interest in protecting both LGBT Americans as well as the religious organizations that seek to serve in accordance with their faith and their values. You know, the faith that God is going to throw the homos into hell, and the values that say that maybe they can help God by moving the process along a little bit. Sincerely, Dr. Joel C. Hunter, Senior Pastor, Northland, a church distributed. Was it a church distributed? What are they, in a warehouse? They got trucks? Father Larry Snyder, CEO, Catholic Charities USA. What does God need with a CEO or a starship? Obligatory Star Trek reference. Kathy Dahlkemper, County Executive, Erie County, PA, former member of Congress. Really? The County Executive of Erie County, PA? How's she got a dog in this hunt? Oh, and there he is. Dr. Rick Warren, Senior Pastor, Saddleback Church. You know, the author of The Porpoise-Driven Life. Gabe Lyons, President, Q Ideas. Dr. Stephen Schneck, Director, Institute for Religion and Democracy, the Catholic University of America. Michael Ware, consultant. And see, that's Barack Obama's buddy. National Faith Vote Director, Obama for America, 2012. Stephanie Summers, CEO, Center for Public Justice. Reverend Noel Castellanos, CEO, Christian Community Development Association. Dr. D. Michael Lindsay. D. Michael Lindsay. DeKalbTown Races. D. Michael Lindsay, President, Gordon College. Andy Crouch, Executive Director, Christianity Today. Stephen Bauman, President and CEO, World Relief. Jenny Yang, Vice President for Policy and Advocacy, World Relief. And Bill Blockery, President and CEO, Bethany Christian Services. That narrows done got all out of its bounds, hasn't it? Mm-hmm. You know it. Note coming in from Kate on the Front Range. Subject line,
WTF. Bob, when I am angry, I'm sorry, I don't have good hearing. Could you talk about this in little words? What does this all mean? How did this all get wrapped into Hobby Lobby? This is all too big. What will happen when an Islamic business takes the same route? Oh, don't worry, Kate, they'll lose, because this is just about real religions. All you got to do is nose around out there in the filth of the right-wing part of the blogosphere, and you'll find statement after statement that Islam is not a real religion. It is a political system, and as such should not enjoy the privileges and rights of a real religion like Christianity. You know what, now that, and this phrase keeps getting brought up about the camel's nose getting under the tent, and I love to analyze metaphors, and we've done this, I've mentioned this a couple of times. What it means is when the camel's nose is under the tent, the camel is in the tent. Because camels just aren't things that you want in your house. And because of the curvy nature of a camel's neck and the fact that it leads to the hump, once the camel's nose is under the tent, the hump is soon to follow, and pretty soon you're standing around in your tent with a camel. Shitting and spitting and stinking. That's what camel's nose under. And so, yeah, what this has to do with Hobby Lobby, Kate, is the fact that Justice Sammy Bad Breath, we are suffering in America, America at present from halitosis. Justice Sammy Bad Breath and golly Moses, if his loving wife heard me call him that, she'd probably cry again. Justice Sammy Bad Breath said that, now this is a narrow decision, Hobby Lobby is, but we're going to say that the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which is undergirded by the First Amendment, which depends on the First Amendment, we're going to say that the Religious Freedom Restoration Act creates a narrow little space for just the tiniest, itsy-bitsiest of camels to get under the tent of discrimination. And we're going to say that Hobby Lobby gets to discriminate against women based upon how they choose to engage in contraception, based on the First Amendment. And golly, this is such a narrow decision. Well, it's not. Because once you carve out a religious exception for one group, you kind of have to keep carving if you're going to remain consistent. And so there's all kinds of cases in the pipelines about how businesses treat LGBT people. And we now have precedent because the Supreme Court is supposed to operate on precedent and a concept called stare decisis. In other words, old decisions get certain, or previously made decisions, get a certain gravity and weight applied to them, unless it can be shown that they are just entirely, utterly, and completely wrong. Supreme Court decisions become the law of the land. And the law of the land now is that a corporation can discriminate, you know, a for-profit, closely held corporation can discriminate against a woman based upon what kind of contraception she chooses, as long as the closely held corporation says it's doing so because Jesus. But once you've allowed that to happen, you have to acknowledge other things, other beliefs, and other areas of inquiry. And so, lo and behold, on Tuesday, July the 1st, you had cases affecting about 50 different companies that were bounced back to their courts of origin, saying, render a decision in accordance with the decision that we have ruled on today. In other words, all the religious objectors win. Now we have the story from the New York Times that Kim sent along that shows that it's being applied to not-for-profit educational institutions. And here we have this letter published in the Atlantic that shows that the religion industry is now jumping out there to say, well, you said we could discriminate against the women. Why can't we, in the name of Jesus, discriminate against women who happen to be lesbians? I mean, that's twice as good a reason to discriminate, isn't it? Because, I mean, not all of us agree about about contraception, and not all of us agree about lesbians. But those of us who want to make sure that no lesbians are out there doling out ladles full of thin pissant soup to the poor, well, if you want to make sure that no lesbians are doing that, by God, as long as you say that Jesus told you, well, you got to let them do it, Barack. You got to let them do it. Or Sammy Bad Breath will slap your ass down again. Narrow decision. Note coming in from our buddy Steve in New York. Subject line, Hobby Lobby rat hole. Bob, stop kicking yourself about not going down the Hobby Lobby rat hole. This case is such a departure from jurisprudence in English or American law dating back 1,000 freaking years that you need to be hammering this home every time it comes up or its implications rear their ugly heads. This decision is so over the top and so egregious, you have no choice but to keep filibobstering. I will tell you this. That decision was the official, unequivocal, last nail in the coffin for the Constitution in this country. Game over. Take your ball and go home. Finis, finito, fertig. The only way to even resurrect this dead republic is to keep reminding everyone, anyone, about this destructive and morally bankrupt decision. Thank you, Steve. I just worry that people are going to think that we're going to change the name of the program to Bob and His One Trick Pony. I haven't gotten up a morning yet since Monday. Actually, I spent Sunday and Saturday dreading Monday. And then Monday happened. And I got up Tuesday morning going, God, what have they done to my country? And I got up Wednesday and it didn't feel any better. And I got up today and it's still icky. And it keeps getting ickier because all that narrowness keeps leaking out of the room and getting filled up with camel. Honest to God, these people that want to discriminate so achingly, I've been saying we haven't been using this word enough, they long to discriminate because it makes them feel better somehow. And I don't understand the sick psychosis involved with that, but it does. It is 7:09 p.m. in the Eastern Daylight Time Zone. That means somewhere in Oklahoma City, it's 6:09 p.m. And the Green family are sitting down and around their dinner table, and they're all holding hands, and they're saying grace, and they're saying, thank you, Jesus, for delivering us from the bondage of the secular humanists. Thank you, Jesus, for making us billionaires who can use our money to force our vision of you upon the rest of the country. Thank you, Jesus, for letting us begin to shred the Constitution into 1,000 tiny, tiny, itsy bitsy microscopic pieces. Thank you, Jesus. It may be apocryphal, but there is that statement about
the Constitutional Convention and someone coming up to old Ben Franklin as he was walking along and saying, Mr. Franklin, what kind of government do we have? And Franklin looking at him and saying, a republic, if you can keep it. You see, going into the Constitutional Convention, there was no guarantee. Hey, tomorrow's the Independence Day. Let's talk about this for a minute. There were no guarantees about what was going to come out of the Constitutional Convention. The Constitutional Convention, legally, under the rules, under the Articles of Confederation, wasn't even supposed to be called. Not a jot, not a dot, not a tittle of the Articles of Confederation could be changed, according to the Articles themselves, without the unanimous agreement of all signatories to it, i.e., the 13 states. So the framers of the Constitution just called a Constitutional Convention and said, we're not changing the Articles of Confederation. We're getting rid of the goddamn things. And all of a sudden, the barn door flew open, and the horse was gone, and it had the bit in its teeth. And there was talk of monarchy. There was talk of unicameral legislatures. There was talk of heredity. All of this stuff. And there was no guarantee of what form the government was going to take. And whether it's true or not, it's a nice story. A republic, if you can keep it. Guess what? We didn't. We didn't. You know what all that business I was saying earlier at the beginning of the program about taking note of everything that went out, went into our independence and our growth as a nation? I retract all of that. Bullshit. Party your brains out tomorrow. Forget about every single human being who ever shed the first damn drop of blood in the name of this nation. Forget it. Eat, drink, and be merry, for this country, this republic, this experiment in self-government is dead. Maybe it died a long time ago. I don't know. But anyone who listens to this program for any length of time knows that I think that this is not a republic. Democracy has never been practiced in this country. I mean, I mentioned the other night the letter from Abigail Adams to John Adams of March 31st, 1776, in which she said, "Do not forget about the ladies, John, because we will foment a rebellion if you do." Well, they did forget about the ladies, and the ladies didn't, because they didn't have any damn rights in the first place. Debates over how much freedom to grant freed slaves in the Congress that was absent the southern states during the Civil War, when they were talking about the question of the vote. Expressly within that debate was the fact that they were talking about black males voting. Neither black females, white females, or native females got the first moment's consideration. We don't do democracy in this country. It is aspirational and not operational. Sorry about that. I didn't mean to put a big old bummer out there, but when you take something as central as freedom from religion and you all but destroy it, as the court did, it is hard to remain dispassionate.
just is. Sixteen minutes past the hour, almost halfway through the program. Some filibobster, sorry. This is a thorn in the front porch Thursday. Hopefully we will be pulling together the evening's roundtable discussion via the Horn Molloy Skype chat group, admirably hosted for lo these many years by the indefatigable Sparky, member of our all-volunteer staff. And if you want to join in on that and you've never sent a contact request, just get on Skype and send a contact request to Sparky Dunk, S-P-A-R-K-Y-D-U-N-C, over on Skype. What else? What else? Oh, this. Since we've been sort of talking about legally stuff. Do you remember a few weeks back when we had that sound clip from Ted Cruz swearing up and down that the Congress was trying to overturn the First Amendment, and he was saying things like, what about the ACLU? What about Planned Parenthood? What will ever become of them once we get rid of the First Amendment? And I said that evening that he was a liar, that the truth wasn't in him. It's nice to have a little bit of, what, affirmation. Enter someone with a lot more legal knowledge than I, the dean of the law school at the University of California, Irvine, who published a piece in the publication The Hill in its Congress blog. Erwin Chemerinsky is the dean of the University of California at Irvine School of Law. And under a headline entitled, Ted Cruz Should Be Ashamed, well, I got that affirmation. Reasonable people, Dean Chemerinsky writes, can disagree on whether it would be good to amend the Constitution to overcome the Supreme Court's decision in Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission. But Senator Ted Cruz's false claims about the proposed amendment have no place in an informed debate. Man, when a law school dean says something like that, yeah, you may not realize it, but he just knocked the spit out of Ted Cruz's mouth. Because remember, Ted Cruz went to Harvard Law, and he's been anointed by his weird-ass father to be king of America. And he's an intellectual. Never mind the fact that people asked about his law school career have said, him? Oh, we couldn't stand him. He was awful. And even in a community like a law school, you've got to be a straight-up 110-proof shit weasel for nobody to like you in law school. Because everybody's stressed out. And the competitive people are going, Jesus, I hope I get on Moot Court. Oh, my God, I'll run over you to get on the law review. You know, because if you get out of Harvard and it says, you know, managing editor, Harvard Law Review, you're going to get some good work. You might actually pay off your student debt before you're 90. The work will be so good. In a series of speeches and writings, Dean Chemerinsky continues, Cruz has lied. Mother, God, when the dean of a law school calls somebody a liar in print, and you know that that dean knows exactly what that means when you do that in print. For instance, that truth is an absolute defense to a charge of defamation or libel or slander, those kinds of, yeah. Cruz has lied about what the amendment would do. Surely we can and must expect more from our elected officials. The occasion for Cruz's wrath is a proposed constitutional amendment concerning campaign finance that is now being considered in the Senate Judiciary Committee. The amendment's purpose is to overturn the Supreme Court's recent decisions that have limited the ability of Congress and state governments to regulate campaign spending. I wish I could remember the date that we ran the audio. I think it would be fun to go back and check it out. In Citizens United, in 2010, the court, 5-4, declared unconstitutional a provision of federal law and held that corporations have the right to spend unlimited amounts of money in independent expenditures in election campaigns. This year, in McCutcheon versus Federal Election Commission, again by a 5-4 vote, the court held unconstitutional another provision of federal law that regulated the total amount that a person could contribute to candidates or political parties in a two-year period. As Justice Breyer lamented in his dissent, these cases eviscerate federal campaign finance law. The proposed constitutional amendment seeks to restore the power of Congress and the states to enact laws of the sort that the court declared unconstitutional in these cases. These laws existed without problems for many years until the Supreme Court declared them unconstitutional. In fact, 7 years before Citizens United, the Supreme Court upheld the very provision that it invalidated in that case. And what he's sort of saying here is that we see the ideological bent of the Supreme Court in glaring relief. We see the fact that they are engaged, as I've noted previously, especially in the last week, they are primarily, the rats are, engaged in ends-based decision-making. In other words, they have an agenda, they have things they want to accomplish, the rats do. And when a case comes along that lets them do it, they start out by saying, here's where we're going to wind up. For instance, we want to allow corporations to be people. That's Citizens United. We want to knock out the amount of money that can be given in a two-year period. That's McCutcheon. We want to allow corporations to discriminate against women over contraception because we hate the Affordable Care Act in the first place, even though we allowed it to exist as a tax. We thought that would maybe knock Barack Obama out of the White House in 2012, but we were wrong. So we're going to double back and see if we can't kill it another way, and we're going to let a corporation that up until 2012 was providing birth control and full contraceptive access in their health plan, we're going to allow them to claim that they suddenly found their consciences and had an epiphany from God and realized that they were killing snowflake babies and they had to keep a woman from being able to get insurance coverage from an IUD via a mandate in the Affordable Care Act. We want to do that. Now, how do we get there? Have you ever worked those maze puzzles in books, the puzzle books? I discovered at an early age that those mazes could be worked a hell of a lot easier if you started at the end and worked back toward the front. This is that. Dean Chemerinsky continues, the proposed constitutional amendment seeks to restore the power of Congress and the states to enact laws of the sort that the court declared unconstitutional in these cases. These laws existed without problems. Okay, we did that. The proposed constitutional amendment in its key provision simply would say, to advance democratic self-government and political equality and to protect the integrity of government and the electoral process, Congress and the states may regulate and set reasonable limits on the raising and spending of money by candidates and others to influence elections. That's a quote. Another provision would make clear the government can limit campaign spending by corporations.
It is impossible to reconcile this language with Cruz's claims about it. We're back to the fact that Ted Cruz is a goddamn liar. In a statement to the Senate Judiciary Committee, Cruz declared, "This amendment here today, if adopted, would repeal the free speech protections of the First Amendment. This amendment, if adopted, would give Congress absolute authority to regulate the political speech of every single American with no limitations whatsoever." Then in the Wall Street Journal, Dean Chemerinsky notes, he said that the amendment gives Congress power to regulate and ban speech by everybody. And Dean Chemerinsky then notes that he ran off to talk to the Family Research Council, headed by Tony Norman, yes, Mother Bates, Perkins. What the amendment says is that politicians in Washington have unlimited constitutional authority to muzzle each and every one of you if you're saying things that government finds inconvenient. Dean Chemerinsky then says, "The amendment does nothing of the sort. It gives no authority to the government to ban or limit anyone's speech. It provides the government no power to muzzle messages the government doesn't like. It doesn't change in any way the long-standing First Amendment principle that the government cannot restrict speech based on the content of the message or the views expressed. The amendment would do no more than allow the government to regulate spending in election campaigns." And then this. You know, these are some long paragraphs. This one's only two sentences long. Cruz's repeat statements are more than just political hyperbole. They are false assertions intended to scare people into opposing the proposed constitutional amendment. And I hate to tell you, Dean, they're working. Because when Ted Cruz says something like this, you can guarantee double to you that the entire evangelical religion industry is out there repeating it verbatim, magnifying it, maximizing it, amplifying it, and preaching it from pulpits from sea to shining sea. Or sea to oily sea, if you prefer. In a statement before a subcommittee of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Cruz said, "Any politician who put his or her name to an amendment taking away the free speech rights of every American, in my view, should be embarrassed." But it is Cruz who should be embarrassed by his false assertions. Ted Cruz is a lawyer who had a very distinguished career in government and private practice. I have debated him on several occasions and know that he is a person of great intelligence. He knows exactly what the proposed amendment would do, and yet has chosen to vilify it by misrepresenting it. Whether it is desirable to try and amend the Constitution to allow campaign finance regulations is the question to be debated. In this and all debates, we should expect and demand honesty from our elected officials. Cruz, in his statements about the proposed campaign finance amendment, is far below the most minimal standards of honesty. Oh, there's that piano again.
Mother.
I mean, when one lawyer says another lawyer is operating below the most minimal standards of honesty. That's about one atom above, why hasn't somebody disbarred this prick? And everything he says is true. Now, I differ this much. You know what Bismarck said about there are two things you never want to see being made, laws and sausages? I think that was Bismarck. Well, what we're dealing with here is a case of overthink. I mean, you heard me quoting Dean Chemerinsky. You heard me quoting what the language of what the language is. Okay.
draft in drafting, language winds up like that because of the desperate attempt of lawyers to make words mean, to make a fluid, interpretable language mean something specific and concrete. And it almost always fails. And the failure rate goes up as the number of words go up. You want to take money out of politics? Pass a constitutional amendment that says politicians shall not accept one thin dime. Not a penny, not a nickel, not any sum over, above, or in any wise interpretable. You know, like, because you've got to do that when you're doing legal language. His heirs, successors, and assigns forever. Amen. You know? So what you really want is a statement that politicians cannot accept money in order to campaign for political office. And that proof of the acceptance of same shall occasion a charge of bribery, a felony, punishable by removal from office, if in office, and imprisonment. And you follow that up with legislation that creates a public financing of political campaigns law. And here's where you wander off into the soggy ground. This is where the stuff starts. This is where the ground starts sucking at your boots. You know who would hate a law like that? Well, sure. Teabaggers, the Koch brothers, libertarians, birthers, deathers, tempters, occupy booger vores in the booger sphere. Sure. But you know who would hate it even more? Come on. The for-profit media. Because every two, and even more so, every 4 years, the for-profit media receive a giant windfall infusion of money. Your money. Again, it is a wealth transfer from your voluntary donations to political candidates. And of course, the millions and billions of you know, the Sheldon Adelsons and the Koch brothers and so forth. They get a big welfare check every 2 years and every 4 years for running advertisements for political candidates. There is an entire sub-economy that operates on monies spent out of political fundraising. There are people who put food on their families. Thank you, dim leader. Because of the perpetual nature of campaign mode in the modern failing empire that is the United States of America. You think they're going to give a nickel's worth of attention to any attempt to do this? You think there's going to be any positive coverage? Don't look for a bunch of it. There might be some, but not much. I mean, you might get some from Al Jazeera America, because Al Jazeera America is probably not going to be getting political ads bought from them. Link TV, Free Speech TV, maybe. Others, not so much. And the real beneficiaries aren't even the networks or the cable networks. The real beneficiaries are the on the ground affiliates in the various communities. They get the money. And they get a lot of it. If you ever study the for-profit broadcasting business or have any experience in it, the sales aspect of it is one of the most gigantic, phony baloney con schemes ever to exist. For instance, in a small market, your radio salesperson goes to Tom's Texaco and sells them ads where they'll say, Tom's Texaco,
Free car wash with fill up on Fridays. And in turn, the salesperson who gets that sale, gets paid a percentage of the money brought in as a commission. The sales manager gets another cut of it. The general manager gets another cut of it. It's like a pyramid scheme. And the actual cost to run the ads is near minimal. And so you're propping up an entire sub-economy. You wonder why it's so hard to find much criticism of Citizens United on ABC, CBS, CNN, Radio TV Rwanda. Well, there's your answer. You wonder why your local news director doesn't show up with editorials on the 11 o'clock news decrying money in politics? There's your answer. Haley in Arkansas noting, the pipeline of dark money flowing like a sewer into LRTV stations is huge this year, LR being Little Rock. Oh, yeah. And then, in turn, the for-profit media then covers everything as a horse race and features the most contentious aspects of the horse race so as to gin up more advertising, which, you know, puts a new blue Buick in the general manager's driveway. Ain't capitalism awesome? Jack with a note, Jack in Shreveport. All this you're talking about is depressing, Bob, but the word booger sphere totally cracks me up. I cannot take credit for it. You must thank our dear friend in Western Wisconsin for that one. Boogervores from the booger sphere. So just sort of take all this into consideration whenever we start thinking about why can't we fix this? Or in the shorthand form, this is why we can't have nice things. Note coming in from Jay. Independence Day. When we celebrate that bunch of colonial malcontents who started us on the path to independence from the old world monarchies, those who envisioned that most noble of concepts, a government of, by, and for the people, those men, I feel, would be mightily distressed to see how that nation is now controlled in large part by crushing corporate greed and religious fanatics. I think they would want a do-over. That part where the need for both houses of Congress and the president to agree or at least compromise in the governance of the nation was naively based on the idea that reasonable and intelligent people would naturally be elected to fill those positions. That part would need to be rethought. The emergence of unrestrained corporate greed supported by large numbers of religious fanatics, large numbers of ignorant Tea Party types, and other fringe groups joined under the collective banner of Republicans has created a stranglehold on the national government. Only the Supreme Court has the chance to act without interference from other parts of the government. But as the Roberts Court has shown, that part can be manipulated to produce decisions heavily skewed to a predetermined bent. And see, the only thing I take issue with in Jay's note is that they would be mightily distressed to see how that nation is now controlled in large part by crushing corporate greed and religious fanatics. Maybe the religious fanatics part, yes. Because they thought they had that licked. But the crushing corporate greed? Please remember, there were no paupers in the Constitutional Convention. Please remember that the war bonds, I mean, and Dr. Bill has talked much more eruditely about this. There were war bonds that were issued. People bought bonds with their money to finance the revolutionary effort. Guess what happened? The young government put forward a plan to buy back the bonds. People on the inside found out about it ahead of time and went out to the yeoman farmers who had financed the revolution, bought the bonds from them for pennies on the dollar because they were cash-strapped in the years following the revolution. Remember the piece of eight, the Spanish coin. Spanish coin was legal tender in the United States for a generation after our independence. Because we didn't have any money. And so the insiders found out that the bonds were going to be bought back and in advance went out to the yeoman farmers, bought them for pennies on the dollar, and then turned around and sold them back to the government as the holders of the bond and got richer. Commercial business interests drove a hell of a lot of the Constitutional Convention. So yeah, Jay, your statement, sigh, I fear we're in deep shit, is truer maybe than most of us even know. So, I have filibustered my way through half of the program this evening. It's time to go to Friday on the Front Porch. We're going to take a wee little break. And then we're going to come back with our round table. It is, it'll be about a quarter to eight. We'll have an hour and 15 minutes of good conversation when we fire up the Horn Molloy Skype chat group. And as noted, the fundraising goal stands at about $370. 220 of that is last night and tonight, and the other 150 is what would happen tomorrow night, but I'm not going to be here, but we still have to count it, you know, because this is all based on an average number of days in a month. So, 150, 220, 370. Right now, we stand at zero going into a long holiday weekend. Jump on in. We've got a good group forming. We've got a good group forming in the Horn Molloy Skype chat group. Plenty of room for you if you want to jump in, too, and you're certainly more than welcome. This is Conversation Radio, the night before Independence Day. Yes, indeed, and whatever that means. I'm Bob Kincaid.
I went home with a waitress the way I always do. I took a little risk. Send lawyers, guns, and money. Dad, get me out of this. I'm the innocent bystander. I got stuck between the rock and the hard place, and I'm down on my luck. Yes, I'm down on my luck. Well, I'm down on my luck. man. 10 lawyers, guns and money. The shit has hit the fan. Guns and money. Yes. Send lawyers, guns and money. Send lawyers, guns and money.
Irresistible, that song. The late, great Warren Zevon. Lawyers, guns, and money. It might ought to be the national anthem, you know? It is because we will not be here tomorrow evening for Friday on the Front Porch. This is Thorn in the Front Porch Friday, Thursday. And we've got a good little group started here. A little something-something I ran across today that might be worth mentioning before we jump to the group. Over at Americans Against the Tea Party, a story by Paul Loeb. Ben Birch over at White Rose Society alerted me to this earlier. Fat Tony Scalia is quoted in a publication called The California Lawyer as answering a question about, here's the question. In 1868, when the 39th Congress was debating and ultimately proposing the 14th Amendment, I don't think anybody would have thought that equal protection applied to sex discrimination or certainly not to sexual orientation. So does that mean we've gone off in error by applying the 14th Amendment to both? Here's Scalia's response. Yes, yes. Sorry to tell you that, but, you know, if indeed the current society has come to different views, that's fine. You do not need the Constitution to reflect the wishes of the current society. Certainly the Constitution does not require discrimination on the basis of sex. The only issue is whether it prohibits it. It doesn't. Now, this is also a man who has said that you do not have a right under the Constitution not to be executed, even if you're innocent of the crime charged. Okay? That is Scaliaism. Nobody ever thought that's what it meant. Nobody ever voted for that. If the current society wants to outlaw discrimination by sex, hey, we have things called legislatures, and they enact things called laws. You don't need a constitution to keep things up to date. All you need is a legislature and a ballot box. You don't like the death penalty anymore? That's fine. You want a right to abortion? There's nothing in the Constitution about that. Bull, 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 bull. What this guy is doing is he's actually trying to protect. He's a fox trying to guard his own hen house. Because Fat Tony Scalia knows that if there are constitutional amendments that make these things clear, that it takes the issue out of his hands, and he can't run around playing little, having his little Mussolini fantasies. Right? Right. Let's go to the Horn Malloy Skype chat group for this Thorn in the Side Porch Thursday. Yeah. Good evening, all. Of course, moderated by the indefatigable Sparky. Haley's with us. Sergi's with us. We have Waggy and Larry and Devin. And let's see, the bunny icon. Is that John?
That's John.
Okay.
From Canada.
Yeah. Hi, gang.
Good evening, Bob.
Good evening, Bob.
Hello.
Hello, hello.
Are we having fun? Or are we standing on the ledge after yet another depressing filibuster?
Are you going to go crawl into the corner and curl up tonight, or what?
I don't think it. No, actually, I can't. I'm gonna unfold my folding chair. Quite honestly, I'm gonna sit right next to the smoker, and I'm periodically gonna throw wet hunks of hickory into it, and I'm gonna drink a beer.
There you go.
That sounds good. I got the tri-tip all rubbed and waiting for tomorrow.
Oh, hot diggity, that's going to be some good.
Mm-hmm. At least I'm not smart metered today.
Oh, brother.
That was miserable yesterday.
Well, it had to be. I guess I'm kind of glad I don't have one. But see, that's probably, you got to understand, Sparky, that's Kenyan Muslim socialism there.
It is?
Absolutely. You never got smart metered back when we were being led by an upstanding Bible-believing, God-fearing Christian like George Bush now, did you?
I can't remember when they put the damn thing on the House.
See, that was back when we had a traditional president.
Is this Pacific Graft and Extortion said you will have a smart meter, and we will have a little device on your compressor unit on your AC so we can turn it off anytime we want.
What's a smart meter?
A smart meter eliminated meter readers. It sends a signal through the power line that they can read how many kilowatts you're using, and how much power you're using a certain time of day, and then they can, the one thing they do is they throttle your air conditioning unit, because the biggest load here in California when it's 100 degrees is everybody's got their AC units on. And so what they do is they do a kind of a rolling brownout, and they do one area, they'll kill your AC unit for a certain amount of hours, and then they'll turn it back on, and then they'll kill somebody else's AC unit if they need to. But it's usually during peak energy demands in the afternoon when it's really a hot day. And then the next day they'll go somewhere else and kill there. I mean, a guy sits in an office with a computer and he can monitor all this shit. Does that kind of explain?
Yes, it does.
Yeah, that's some job killing regulations.
Yeah, and it's just terrible that they do it in order to prevent the entire state of California from being without power. Because, you know, that's what you would really want to have in a free market, is just blowing up the whole system.
Absolutely.
Our power grid here in Texas, over the last few years, has started to get strained in the summertime here. You know, there's the local news, you know, 4, 5, 8, 11, 33, radio stations, such like that, you know, around here. Like, be sure to, you know, conserve electricity. Don't set your AC too low and da-da-da-da-da, or else we'll blow the power for the whole state of Texas. And I'm just
and
like,
see,
no, that's not right.
That's
what the media up here says. I mean, I'm not stating the veracity of it. I'm just saying what the media is saying.
Yeah, and it's no surprise that, you know, they're stretching things a bit.
Well, see, underneath all of this is a little bit of historical reality, and that is, prior to the arrival of electricity on the scene and the invention of air conditioning, there was a reason, and it was geographical and climatological, as to why the southern United States were much more sparsely populated than the north. You know, not to run off into the weeds of history, but there's a reason that there was much more population for the north to throw into the, you know, the recent unpleasantness than the south had. And that is because it is unbearably hot. I mean, you've got the fine dainty ladies of the American South, you know, sitting there fanning themselves in their hoop skirts before all of this happens. Only with the arrival of air conditioning does a population explosion take place in the South, so that Atlanta gets as big as it is, and Nashville as big as it is, and Texas becomes as wildly populated as it is. Before electricity and before air conditioning, it was much more. I mean, there's a reason all those stately oak trees stood around the mansion, and there's a reason why even humble abodes often had a few stately oaks around it because that's a passive way of keeping the place at least tolerably cool.
Yeah, I mean, you know, as far as, you know, Texas goes, you know, a large reason why our power grid is starting to get strained, though, is all these McMansions. You know, Texas is built on suburban sprawl. I mean, that's, you know, Texas is one of those states that's pretty much built on suburban sprawl. We don't really have cities here. We have amalgamations of sprawl burbs. And, you know, all these huge oversized McMansions, you know, that, you know, people living in way too much house, you know, for what they really need.
Yeah, Limbaugh down in Florida in a 27,000 square foot house with a maid, the cat, and his wife in a pit.
Yeah, and you know they try to. They'll. Because, you know, most people, they crank their thermostats pretty daggum low in the summertime. So, you know, they'll crank their, say, you know, 72, 70, 68, 66, whatever. And that whole house getting cooled, then multiply that times hundreds of thousands, millions of these McMansions. Surprise, power strain.
Well, and surprise, ancient, antiquated, low-tech grid.
Oh, yeah, there is that, too. I mean, in my neighborhood...
Not to interrupt too badly and jump in on you, Sergi, but for the first time in my life, and the only time in my life, last September, at the invitation of our dear friend Dr. Allen and the Waco Friends of Peace, I flew into Dallas. And I just started, because I'm forever looking out the window on an airplane. You know, I get motion sickness if I try to read or anything. So I just sit there and look out the window. And all of a sudden, this thing appears on the ground beneath me that looks like one of those nightmare visions of Geiger, you know, who designed, you know, the alien landscape for the movies and everything. It's just this, yeah, and this curling and geometric, and it seems to have no rhyme or reason. It looks like an amoeba. And it just goes forever, you know, and that's Dallas.
Yeah, it was DFW International, right, that you landed in at?
Yeah.
Yeah, so what you were seeing, okay, was Frisco, Louisville, which is not, you know, a lot of people, when they get down, it's like, is it Louisville? No, it's Louisville. Ours is actually pronounced just Louisville. You know, you saw Corinth, you saw the Colony, you saw McKinney, and it's just endless, curly-cue suburban sprawl. That is what you saw. And I mean, it's wasteful, it's excess, but it's what we have.
Right. Remember how everybody laughed at, Al Gore for worrying about sprawl? I do.
And like many prophets, he was mocked in his own time. However, we have to remember that we have seen major massive power outages. The derecho in 2012 did that. That
Hello.
Was another...
Yeah, I remember the derecho.
Yeah, so I have to wonder how sustainable sprawl is in the long run, simply because we are living with a changing world, changing energy needs, and sadly, I don't think we are seeing much leadership, but then again, the quality of our political leadership these days is almost so bad that if you could find a way to hook them up, the Founding Fathers could generate power from spinning in their graves.
Well, but consider this, the effect of sprawl could be vastly ameliorated, could it not, if all of those sprawl houses had solar panels on their roofs.
Yeah,
and were contributing to a distributed grid.
Well, consider this. Germany is the cloudiest nation in Europe. They have been able to, via public policy, that actually works with homeowners. I know that's heresy to the Republicans, public policy that works for people, not corporations. get enough solar panels installed that they are going non-nuclear and replace one nuclear power plant. Most Israeli homes, as I understand, have solar water heaters. The technology is out there. The problem is the big corporations are afraid to use, are afraid of it. We've even had efforts in Utah to block people from having solar panels by charging them more money. Fortunately, there was a big reaction to that, but I think we honestly are at a point where we need to take a good look at everything and ask ourselves hard questions. I suspect they'll come from the people because, unfortunately, many of our politicians, I'm afraid their big contribution will be when they decay back into the soil.
Well, that's entirely yeah. likely, and we should remember that that all of this, well, you know, with the, for instance, the way the German law works, when production via renewable sources is going wild, German coal-fired power plants actually have to shut down and quit kicking electricity onto the grid. And they're screaming bloody murder, you're putting us out of business. Well, it's kind of the goal, isn't it?
Yes. And may I quote Rob H. Heinlein from the short story Lifeline, which was one of his earliest. A judge is in a case where insurance companies are suing a man who has found a way to predict exactly how long people will live and tells the insurance companies, sorry, there's nothing in the law that's guaranteed to have any industry to have a profit forever. Your argument sounds like the one I imagine the buggy makers and buggy whip makers made at the turn of the 20th century.
It's exactly that. It is exactly that. Well, along the lines of this, you might get a kick out of this. I wanted to make sure we got to these two stories this evening. And by the way, remember that at a meeting of the Koch brothers, and we talked about this a little bit last night after hours, at a meeting of the Koch brothers last year, they determined that they were going to live and die on attacking people who have solar panels on their roofs, and they came up with a name. We've talked about it before. They came up with a name to call them. They're called free riders. Notice the sort of linguistic association with the concept of freeloaders. These are, and they're saying, well, they're putting stuff out there on the grid, and they ain't even having to pay for the grid. And so they want to make it harder for people to do that. And I mention that because Grant was in the room at the time, and it was one of the first times I'd really heard one of his classic patented Grant rants. And it was a beautiful thing to behold. News out yesterday, 9 states, remember in the Green News report yesterday, they were talking about, evil, crazy ass old Bob Murray who's suing the EPA. Because they're lying about climate change. Every year keeps a getting colder. That Bob Murray. He sued. Here's the fun part. He has now been joined in that lawsuit via a brief filing from attorneys general in West Virginia, Wyoming, South Carolina, Ohio, Nebraska, Oklahoma, Alaska, Alabama, and Kentucky, saying that claiming that the EPA should not be allowed to regulate carbon from existing coal-fired power plants. And that they're trying to impose double regulations on coal plants everywhere, and it's unconstitutional, and Jesus doesn't like it, and probably is crying, and it might cause God to send a tornado to squash something in Oklahoma flat, and you know all the stuff that these people insanely scream, and it all it's all a direct assault on the Clean Air Act. So just understand that this is not. Because we've spent a lot of time on Hobby Lobby, that ain't all that's happening. On the other hand, though, and I think you'll be fascinated with this, except for the fact that so there's a decision that's been rendered in Colorado by a U.S. District Court judge, Judge Jackson.
And, of course, it'll be appealed to whatever circuit that is, and that'll be appealed to the Supreme Court of the United States. Judge Jackson in the United States District Court in Colorado ruled against Arch Coal and their operation. It's called the West Elk Mine. It's a strip mine, okay? It's a surface mine. It's nasty. It's vile. It's filthy. It's toxic. And what he held was that Arch Coal couldn't expand the West Elk Mine because federal regulators had failed to take into account the social cost of carbon. And he said straight up that the Bureau of Land Management and the Forest Service didn't take into account what it costs the people of the United States to emit carbon emissions from the mining and combustion operations that are associated with the mine's expansion. The mining itself. I mean, I hooted. I hooted when I read this. Because it opens, well, Sergi, last night we were talking about, you know, Appalachia is the cradle of climate change. You know, we can talk about emissions from coal-fired power plants till the cows come home, but if we're not talking about what's happening at the mine site, that's where the carbon's coming from. It's not from the combustion, it is from the extraction from the earth. And, curiously, the poisoning of the people who live around the sites. And so this district court judge has said, you didn't take into account what's happening at the extraction site. You can't expand the mine.
They're being called on the externalities, which is a first.
Yes.
Because for those who are not familiar with the phrase externalities, it simply refers to whatever you do, the side effects. So, Bob, if I were to have a huge barbecue next to your house and the soot dirtied your house and got into your vents and drove the dog crazy, that would be an externality. And this is one of the key things industry worries about. They fear that they will actually have to pay externalities. For example, gas is now roughly a little under $4 a gallon. However, one could argue that the actual price should be 8 to 10 once you figure out the externalities of health, pollution, the military defense budget to patrol the shipping lanes, and other things. I am amused that the Attorney General of Alaska joined in that suit you mentioned because Alaska is already experiencing climate change refugees. The Guardian, as well as the Daily Mail, reported on that last year. A few villages are set to disappear in the next 5 to 10 years. But, of course, those are Inuit villages, so I'm not sure if the Attorney General of Alaska gives a flying fig about it. Is there water?
Is someone using the restroom?
I don't know.
Being a professional broadcaster, I was going to let it go unremarked upon, but, yeah, I heard it, too.
Is someone recording Antonin Scalia's brain draining through his ears?
Oh, it would be much more of a trickle were it that. Well, no, you're absolutely right about all the externalities, Will, and here's where it gets fascinating. Part of the reason the judge was able to do this in Colorado is because the Bureau of Land Management and the Forest Service were involved because it was public lands. It was we the people's land in the first place. And it impacts the Colorado roadless rule because it's part of a backcountry in western Colorado. So that triggers certain involvements that might not otherwise take place. But here's the fun part. In doing the analysis, originally, in doing the analysis for the expansion of this hell pit, the Bureau of Land Management and the Forest Service calculated the social cost of the carbon. And they came up with a figure. And that figure was $984 million. But once they came up with that number and were preparing to put it into their draft report, somebody leaned on the agency and said, get that out of there. What the hell do you think you're doing?
We got to protect our phony baloney jobs, gentlemen. And so suddenly, and with no explanation, poof, the social cost of the carbon extracted disappeared from the report. And when Judge Jackson found out about it, he said, wait a minute. Because at the same time, in preparing the final report, the agencies had also included numbers on the associated benefits of the mine. You know, like the guy down the road who makes bologna sandwiches at the local Rippy Mart. Now that was going to be a cold job. And so that kind of crap gets included. But we take out the $984 million in externalities that are going to come out of the hide of we the people. And the judge wouldn't tolerate it. And so, I mean, this is a big deal. But it's only a big deal as long as it stands. If this thing gets bounced at the appellate level, or God knows goes to the Supreme Court, where it'll probably quietly be taken out back, and, you know, Fat Tony will cudgel it to death. Now, there's nothing in the Constitution that says we have to live on a planet. Most of the world didn't even know we were on a planet when the Constitution was drafted.
They did.
See what I mean, though?
Yes. I mean, what I find rather distressing about the conservative mind as it now exists is that facts do not matter. Ideology trumps anything. As someone who believes in using facts and logic while respecting the beliefs of others, this troubles me. And I don't know if you saw the piece Robert Reich, former Secretary of Labor under Bill Clinton, wrote about the conservative mind, but it's as if we have two very radically different mindsets, where if you say freedom and I say freedom, you and I are pretty much on the same page, whereas for them, freedom may be the freedom to have a market that's pretty much unregulated, where you can pay workers whatever you choose. So I think we are in the case you're mentioning, we're seeing a fundamental difference of worldview between the judge and those who took the facts out.
Well, one of the things that I think that informs this ruling, Will, is that judges hate to be lied to. Now, there was no finding of perjury here, but judges, the ones who take their jobs seriously, have to have every available relevant fact in order to reach a correct decision. And if you're reading a report and then you find out there were $984 million worth of externalities that just somehow got, you know, rat-holed, you're going to be pissed. And you will, in your ruling, take that stuff into consideration, even though the agency didn't wanna. But this is, you know, this is another manifestation of the dirty influence of industry on government. It happens all the time. There are reports out there, and I know this. I do not speculate this. I know this. There are reports out there that have been a year and a half, 2 years, 2.5 years in the making. And they're still not out there. They haven't been released. They should have been released a year ago. They haven't been. And we keep saying, hey, where the hell is it? Don't know. They won't let it out. And this is true particularly when the data to be released, like $984 million in externalities in Colorado, would be damaging to the profiteering of the money. Because money. Because capitalism. Because we don't have a precautionary principle. Because we put making of profit before letting people continue to live.
To quote Calvin Coolidge, the business of America is business.
Exactly, Will. You know, if something should ever wildly happen and I wind up in Congress, the first bill I'm going to introduce is going to be a bill to strike In God We Trust from the money and put the business of America is business on there, because that is our real national established religion.
It is, because let's be blunt. You are in West Virginia, and I am just outside Chicago. For those who know the labor movement's history, there was a lot of bloodshed in both places by people demanding things that we take for granted. A decent day's pay for a decent day wage. Reasonable limits on how long you can work. An end to child labor. And yet, and I fear that with this Supreme Court majority, they are probably just now, as they are sitting around over the mint juleps or anything else they're drinking, trying to figure out what case they can take next year to give another cut in the death of a thousand cuts in the rights of working people in this country.
Oh yeah. See, like this morning, I got a text from Ben Birch about the article in the California Law Journal with the quote from Scalia about no guarantee of non-discrimination to women in the Constitution, and all I got from Ben at first was, "Did you see about Scalia?" And my pink little ears perked up and went, "Is he dead? Damn." No, it just turned out that he issued another fascist encomium.
Right, and I don't know if you saw it. I may have posted it to your page, and if not, I didn't. Clarence Thomas, I believe back in May, I believe of this year, said it would be perfectly fine if individual states chose to establish their own religion. Let's see. I wonder what religion would be established by the state legislature in Mississippi.
Oh, wait! You said the magic word. The duck just dropped. Mississippi. That place is getting weirder by the microsecond.
Yeah, I actually, while I was out, I actually heard a conversation about the press conference that Ted Cochran said.
Yeah, it wasn't a press conference. It was a conference call. And the Cochran campaign had set it up to talk about the aftermath of the runoff and, you know, going forward and all of that stuff. But nobody had a mute button. And this is the fun part. They had no power to mute the people who were listening in and then allow them to speak. There was no way to create order. So they go into the meat and potato, or, you know, they get started on the press conference, the conference call, and suddenly some identified person starts hollering, "Negroes harvested cotton, and Ted Cochran harvested Negro votes." I kid you not.
I actually heard the tape, and my reaction was, this is very vile, and it should completely disabuse people of the notion that racism is gone in this country. One of the reasons that Ted Cochran gave people to vote for him, regardless of race, is you bring money back, and based on the census report that 1 in 3 people in the South live in poor neighborhoods, Mississippi could use the money. Bob, in the chat and in the Skype chat, I'll post an article I found at the Daily Mail. But, I mean, literally, I don't know which is more disturbing, the fact that we have people making these remarks in 2014 remarks that easily could have been said at the height of segregation, or the fact that a lot of the basic problems, such as poverty, have not been addressed in those areas. If you look at the map in the article, you'll see a deep shade of blue on the poorest states, and you see them, you see in West Virginia, you see in Mississippi, and other things. And unfortunately, I fear a lot of attitudes are not going to change. I think generational change will get rid of the tea baggers eventually, but it's going to be a long, hard road, and we should have no illusions that we are fighting on our side those who, not only in the words of William F. Buckley, would stand astride the arc of history and say, stop, but would actually shout, go back to where you came from.
I got a conference call once from my congressman. I just started yelling into the phone because I didn't want to hear it. It's on my dad's phone, but of course they were trying to get a hold of him. But I you know, 26 years a Republican is just drove me nuts. So I just went off. It just felt good, but I know nobody heard me.
Yeah, you were muted. These guys didn't have the common sense to set up a conference call with a mute button. It's laughable on the one hand, but on the other, look, we're dealing, insurgencies are a form of what the Pentagon calls asymmetrical warfare. And in this case, asymmetrical warfare takes the form of this guy screaming so much that nobody can have the conference call. We are in the midst, in this crumbling empire, of an insurgency. And it's taking place all around us, and everybody thinks that as long as, well, the cable's still on. I mean, this is, and we can't blame it entirely on climate change, you know, the fact that you got smart metered, Sparky. This is 2014 in the United States of America. We ought not be having rolling brownouts in California or Texas or anywhere else for that matter. We have the technology to prevent them. We have the ability. It is not rocket science, the concept of solarizing this country. How many people would we put to work if we started training people who wanted to work in how to do wind and solar?
Hundreds.
Yeah, what would happen to the IBEW? How many people would still be on the bench?
Well, we're doing it. I mean, I'm not part of it anymore, but they're doing it. San Diego's got one training center just dedicated to solar.
I mean, what would happen if we passed a law in the Congress? I know this sounds like fantasy stuff. What would happen if we passed a law in the Congress that said that every federal building constructed, every building constructed with federal tax dollars, would be not only LEED certified, but would be capable of generating its own electricity? You know, golly Moses, if Wally World can make a decision to get off the grid, and they have the roof and the parking lot space to do it, why can't the government of we the people that actually sent human beings to the moon do that? All Wally World knows how to do is to get cheap crap from China across the Pacific.
We have a Walmart distribution center here. They have the biggest, gigantic wind turbine you've ever seen.
Right, because they're cost conscious.
They're thinking about putting in more.
Oh, by the way, I have to go off topic here for a minute based on our last night's conversation, Sparky. What did you opt for in the way of charcoal for your tri-tip?
I haven't gone to the store yet.
Well, that thing won't take. How long does it take for you to do that? What, hour? 2 hours?
Yeah, hour.
Yeah. Well, I'm trying.
I think I might go down and get some. At the butcher shop, they sell these. They're promoting these like wood chip barbecue things or something.
Mm-hmm.
And they have this special chips or something you burn in them.
Hmm.
I might try some of those.
Just well, I'm experimenting. I'm experimenting this
pellets,
evening.
Yeah, John Cuse's pellets.
Yeah. Yeah, but those things are going to be full of glue and binders and stuff.
Oh.
But I mean, there's binders and then there's binders. I was reading on the. I'm experimenting with a brand I've never used before. The Stubbs's briquette, and they guarantee on the bag that it's 95% hardwood and 5% vegetable binder to create the briquettes. And they come from the Duraflame company of somewhere in California. So, but they don't smell nasty when you're burning them down to, you know, to coals. So I don't think they're going to impart any nastiness onto my buck 89-pound ribs.
I mean, a few years ago, I got into the chimney starters for the coals instead of using the.
Oh yeah, I hate
charcoal starter.
Yeah, I hate charcoal starter. Why not just pour some gasoline on your meat? Well, that didn't sound very nice, did it?
Hopefully, it'll turn out like that picture I showed you last night.
Well, it'll be yummy if it does. Do you like horseradish?
No.
Oh, okay. Never mind. For stuff like that, or sometimes you can catch them on sale. The whole sirloin tip, the whole thing. And we used to smoke those, and I would make a homemade horseradish sauce to go with them. And whoa, if you like horseradish, yum. Oh, and good news, very good news. Thanks to Horzak and Thomas and Henry, we are not in as bad a shape as we were as we approached the end of the program. Thanks to those three, we are only $15 away from meeting last night and tonight, and that means $165 away from meeting last night, tonight, and tomorrow. So that's much better than it was. Thank you very much to Horzak and Thomas and to Henry. Wait a minute, Asa. There's Asa.
Ah.
Wow, okay. We are now even with last night and tonight, and we've only got $150 to go to take care of tomorrow.
Well, I would say that if you like what you hear, the horn could definitely use the money because... As someone who has been around people who ran shows from out of their homes, it's not easy. There's expenses, there's challenges, there's always bills to pay. And where else can you get in-depth conversation? We don't break for commercials here at the Horn. You can actually...
We don't even break to take a leak. I'm sorry.
No.
No.
Night for win.
Some of us do.
too much information. I'm sorry. I'm going to get it. I'll get mail about that.
But I mean, here's the point. One thing we try to do here at the Horn as listeners, as well as yourself, Bob, as a host, as well as Dr. Bill O'Brien and Rick Smith, is carry on conversations. And I would urge people who haven't listened to the other shows to please do so. And if you are listening to those shows, yes, you can hit the PayPal button too. You can hit it at midnight if you want. But we are willing, at least on our side, to have dialogue. Well, it seems like is happening in the GOP is they are becoming afraid of any range of opinion within their own party.
Absolutely.
I mean, you now have, in the case of Mississippi, the people saying Tad Cochran is not Republican enough. And when I hear that, I think of the problems that Mickey Weinstein of the Military Religious Freedom Foundation has encountered. The biggest group of clients they have are Christians who are told by their peers or superiors in the military, well, you're really not Christian enough, or you're not the right sort. And this, to me, when you limit the dialogue, when you limit the range of opinions, I think you lose out. And this is one of the reasons why we have to be willing to discuss the issues. I mean, good heavens, if we don't talk about the issues and act, who will? Because in the end, I think the only way change has ever come in this country is from the ground up.
I think it boils down to intelligent curiosity. Right-wingers don't have the curiosity to check facts.
It's not in their interest to check facts.
They just believe what they've been told, and that's it.
Yes, and I don't think that is a good approach to democracy. Jefferson said that the only way democracy would work is with the informed public. And we have entire news networks, air quotes there, and talk shows where the point is not to inform the voter, but to rather enrage, annoy, misinform, and to convince people that their primary role in society is not as a participant, but rather as someone who sits back, sends a little bit of money in, and has other people make the decisions.
That, and I mean, it's not even just, you know, outfits like, you know, Fox News. It's, I mean, most people in the United States don't even watch the news. You look at the viewership for, like, you know, Honey Boo Boo Child or, you know, the Kardashians, whatever they're doing. Those ratings, like, compared to, you know, crap bread and circuses like that, even Fox News is a non-factor. You know, people just don't like being informed, I suppose. I don't know what it is. I haven't been able to wrap my mind around it.
Well, it may be that people who are working hard, in some cases working two jobs just to make ends meet, want to be distracted. And while this can be understandable, it's not productive. And this is where I think role of us as individuals can get in there. I've talked to family members and neighbors about elections when people had a chance to talk about issues. We have to be unafraid to talk, and sometimes that personal contact is what makes the difference. I mean, we can't underestimate our own power. We tend to rely on experts in our society. We tend to turn towards people who can tell us, how do I make this work or how do I build this? Well, we can be sort of experts on the facts and the issues and try to work with people. It would be easier if we actually had media parity so that Bob could be on 500 stations and have top-of-the-line sound equipment. But we are stuck with the world we live in, but we can try to change it. If we don't think we can, then perhaps those who just wish to be distracted are right, and we should turn on the Kardashians. Sorry, that was a Star Trek reference, I didn't mean. that and be entertained. But I think we can do better as a democracy. Heck, I think we owe it to anyone who's ever tried to make a difference in this country or this world to do so.
I know back when I was working, I had to come home and find a distraction to turn it off because, I mean, I was into my job for those 8 hours. I mean, it was just like blueprints and dealing with engineers and everything because I used to be a foreman on projects, you know, electrical installation projects, water treatment plants, you know, administration buildings, and just, I mean, I would just be all day long running all the work into my mind, and then when I got home, I needed a distraction to get it out of my mind, or you think about it all night, you wake up thinking about it. It's hard to get it out of your mind. And now what's really crazy is when I dream about work. I'm back on a job site somewhere and something weird's happening to me. And then I wake up because it's always like a it's kind of like a nightmare, but it's not a nightmare.
That's what our society does to you.
I can't find my tools or I lost my hard hat or something really stupid, but I mean, it's just, I don't know why, but I dream about it now. And now I read the internet all day and do other things like maintain this house, but it was something.
The way that people have to work in this country, you know, it's unnatural. It's not necessarily that you, even that you have to work so much, but, you know, the way that you have to, you know, you're there for, you know, however many hours and you get, you know, two breaks and a lunch.
Yeah, they treat people like they're machines at work.
Yeah.
You know, that's how the in business administration, they used to teach these, the Taylor system of work, and that was a system of work that was developed during the Industrial Revolution. You know, that's when the human relations field started. It was, how do we get as many people in here, we get a few people in here to create as many widgets just so that we can put out product. And they're more interested in putting out product from people rather than making people from, in other words, the products are there to serve, the people are there to serve the products rather than the products being there to serve people. I think you understand.
That's the very essence, Larry, of the motivating idea behind a consumer culture.
Yeah,
I think consumer is one of the most odious phrases in modern parlance. It's like calling a human being an eater.
That's true, but it's there also the other side of it is that if you're a person, and I shouldn't presume to know anything, but if you're living like you live, and like I think that a lot of people in West Virginia, it's you know, maybe people don't need to consume as much in certain classes or in certain places in the society, but there are some people that really need certain things in order to be able to make their, in order to make their lives livable and tolerable, you know, that don't have the ability to consume. So, and it's interesting that there are a lot of these, a lot of students around me and people around me are saying, you know, to poo-poo on the consumer culture and not to worry so much about money. But you can't tell somebody who's never had any money that they shouldn't worry about money. I mean, it's fine to be able to tell
somebody. That's something that is said by people who've never had to worry about it. You're absolutely right, Larry. And, you know, the right wing is forever saying things like, well, them liberals just want to solve problems by throwing money at it. I've heard that more. So, well, it, obviously, I can quote it in chapter and verse. But the fact of the matter is, in a capitalist society, there aren't many problems that can't be solved by money, or at least by taking money into account. Classic case in point being this case out of Colorado. Everything changed when the judge realized that they had buried $984 million in externalized costs, social costs.
Yep.
And, I mean, but the word itself, you know, we are now, people who go to the doctor are now referred to as healthcare consumers.
Oh, God.
And, yes. And
well, having a consumer, that means that something or someone is consumed.
Well, it does, and it also sort of carries a freight, Devin, of finiteness. You know, oil is finite, coal is finite, gas is finite. I know. And so the presumption there is that, well, because finiteness, scarcity, is the foundation upon which capitalism is grounded. So we're going to call people healthcare consumers because they're consuming a finite resource. You know, there's only so much health to go around. Somebody's got to die.
Yeah. That's interesting. That's an interesting observation, Bob.
Well, I do try to be interesting, Larry.
Well, sure, because they limit the amount of doctors. Yeah.
Yeah.
So artificial scarcity. Right.
Right.
If everybody could go to medical school, then the doctors wouldn't have their special legalese. I'm thinking about lawyers now, Bob. But you know, doctors wouldn't have their medicalese, and with lawyers, you know, you have to go through this system in order to become a lawyer. So you can talk about things in ways that the average person can't, you know, can't understand.
Yeah, that's like Kate writing in earlier and say, would you please explain how this happened and do it in little words, because I'm too pissed off.
Yeah, the AMA is one of the best damn unions there is. It just doesn't call itself a union.
Right. It absolutely is. And the fact of the matter is, while there is a great deal of learning and skill set development that goes into the practice of medicine, there are lots and lots of people who are completely capable of attending medical school and doing fine in it who don't get to go.
That's right.
Because an artificial level of scarcity is maintained that is begun with, by, and for the American Medical Association.
Yeah. Or they end up as only getting to a point where they can be a PA and then, you know, that's it.
Well, And yet, you're more likely, and this wasn't always the case. It used to be when you went to the doctor, you saw the doctor.
They build in the competition, like Berkeley, you know, right down the street from me. That's such an anxiety factory, and the competition is at such a high level. There's no reason that they need to have all that people jumping through hoops to be able to study their.
Right, and colleges have fits over fraternity hazing, and rightfully so, because it's brutal, it's ugly, it's inhumane, and it should never happen. But you know what? The medical internship and residency requirement is hazing. It's an initiation ritual. It's goat riding, okay? A doctor is not made a better doctor by being sleep-deprived for 365 days.
Well, they've killed that.
Well, you know,
they've ended that practice. The physicians coming out over the last, it's only been like 5 to 10 years, have been orders of magnitude different from the ones that, you know, preceded for a century.
Well, you know, Bob, you know, I've talked to Waggy about this, and I've heard about it in just about every graduate school program, no matter what it is. The whole point of, like, engineering school or law school or medical school or any graduate program is to put you through, and it happens on the undergraduate level at Berkeley. It's all about weeding out people, trying to figure out how they can distill
you know, the students who can withstand as much pressure and be able to survive it. And if you can survive that kind of pressure and deal with it, and the more easily you can deal with that pressure, the higher you go. And if those people that can't deal with the pressure, no matter what field it is, they can't make it, they don't. And ultimately, it's
I love that. I love that phrase, Larry, anxiety factory.
Well, it is an anxiety factory. It is. It really is. I mean.
Well, see, I mean, even at a crappy little state school like the one I went to, there are always going to be the people there who are just that way. I mean, I'm about as type A as a human being can get, but you know, like, you know, toddling off to Harvard on the Mon and up there on Tort Flats, you know, I saw those people who were absolutely driven. You know, the sun might not rise, it might not come up the next morning. Life might not be worth living if they were not the president of the moot court board. And I just said, really? You define yourself that way? Because I couldn't understand it. Maybe that just means I'm not properly motivated.
Yeah, well, I know type A. I wanted to ask a question about, because I met somebody in the post office today who is with San Bruno Mountain Watch, and he teaches Native American studies. I'm sorry, folks. But he mentioned that he worked with somebody from Cold River Mountain Watch that died. His name is Larry Givens. Did you know that name, Bob?
No, Larry Gibson. And he was with Keepers of the Mountains. And the Memorial 4th of July Festival will be held tomorrow on Larry's Mountain. And there's going to be a big party, and I'm really proud of them. The Keepers of the Mountain is having a huge mountain celebration. And it's going to be the first ever solar powered anti-mountaintop removal concert. There's all kinds of musicians and stuff going to play. I'd love to be there, but I can't. But Larry,
okay.
Yeah, Larry Gibson. Larry Gibson died with a weed eater in his hand, trying to take care of his property that exists as a little oasis of green in the midst of a gigantic. A gigantic sea of devastation and hellscape.
Okay.
And he died young.
Are they going to use one of them solar panel trailers?
I have no idea. No, it's pretty tough.
Have you ever seen those?
Yeah, I have, and I think it's probably going to be more like the portable solar kind of situation, just because it would be a booger to get one of those trailers up on the mountain.
Oh.
Interesting note coming in.
They're making them in different sizes.
Interesting note coming in from Steve in China. He says, what I'm hearing now, the conversation we've been having, comments about dreams, nightmares, and so on, sounds to me like the root meaning of what we mean by trauma. Traumas are, at one level, deep disturbances of the psychic life that take on the form of dream, fantasy, and so forth. Things that seem real that can't be real and yet are all too real might be a useful working definition. A steady job, decent wages, and a 30-day vacation take care of so much of this disoriented dream life. Yes? And yeah, they do. And the nice thing is, though, if you're a Koch brother or something, you want a traumatized workforce. You want a workforce that is in a constant state of fear and one step away from disaster.
Wasn't it Alan Greenspan who said that his job was to make sure that workers were not too comfortable?
I don't know if that
works to that effect.
Well, being as he was a big fan of Ayn Rand, it would not surprise me. Hey, further good news. You know, we got past the $220 mark, and we are now only $125 away from finishing up fundraising for the first week of July. Thank you very much to Greg for getting us there. So there's only $125 remaining, which is awesome.
Well, hopefully we'll see it happen over today. Tomorrow and the weekend, although I know you plan to be off, will there be something running on the stream?
Oh, unless Chantel screws me over, the rerun stream of the entire week's broadcast of Dr. Bill and me will be rolling just in a constant loop. And that's, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 12, 14. You know, that's 18 hours of programming.
Right, and I would urge those who haven't listened to Dr. Bill to please do so, as they will likely enjoy it and learn something. I particularly like the comment I heard this week where you compared Republicans' embrace of Lincoln with the founders to the way evangelical Christians interpret the role of Paul in Christianity.
And that one, yeah, Will, that one just came out of the blue. I mean, it was like a lightning bolt. Because it's the same thing.
Yes.
And in the early church, the disciples, the people who had actually walked with Yeshua, took umbrage at this jumped up psychopath.
Right, and I mean there was a lot of difference in his doctrines. I think where Paul succeeded is he modified things to make them more acceptable to a wider audience.
Right. Well, he took some basics. He took some basic tenets of. Well, no, he didn't even take the basic tenets. All he took was the crucifixion and the resurrection, and built his own doctrine and dogma around it that would be palatable to a Hellenic audience.
Yes.
Or to people who had, you know, who had been exposed to the civilizing features of Greek thought and Greek culture. You know, that's why the letters are to the church at Ephesus and the church at Corinth and the church at Philippi and, you know, so forth. But if you read with a critical eye, if you read the book of Acts with a critical eye, you will see that there was a profound disruption, and people didn't Peter and James did not like Paul, because Peter and James were nice, law-abiding, and Will, you know what I mean by that, Jewish boys.
Yes. Yes. And ironically, I understand that there may have been in the time of the Crusades a sect in Israel/Palestine, which may have been descended from of the Church of James and others, but I believe that vanished very quickly. It might have vanished earlier. But in the case of the Republicans, they tend to construct a hagiography out of our history, whereas I see much good in our history. I also have to admit the bad, the three-fifths rule in the Constitution, genocide and like, but I think what is our strength as a nation is that we always have people willing to be self-criticizing, realizing there is good in this country, but we have yet to live up to our promise. And that's where we get people like Dr. King and others who force us to look at ourselves and say, there's a check that has not been cashed yet.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah. Not that I've read the Bible, but...
Good start!
Know it. But is there anything of any value in any of that stuff? Or
well, sure it is. Sure it is. You know, for instance, a little bit ago, Larry, Will mentioned Al Gore and said a prophet is never welcome in his own land, or is never honored in his own land. You know,
Jesus quoted that from earlier. I mean, a lot of our literary analogies and like only make sense. You can read the Song of Songs as love poetry like anything else composed over several thousand years. There's different aspects and different angles.
Sure. And all I was going to say is that where prophets are concerned, you know, God used to take good care of his prophets. I mean, some little boys were making fun of Elisha's bald patch one time, and God sent a bear out of the woods and had the little boys devoured.
My understanding of the Hebrews, they were actually teenagers, so if they were more like a street gang, perhaps. But, I mean, one thing you have to remember
Right, but my point is God sent a bear to devour them for making fun of his bald spot. And yet, you got Rush Limbaugh gets a little deafness out of it, I guess, for all the mockery he did of Al Gore.
Well, in the case of Rush Limbaugh, I fear that for him. Well, actually, I don't fear. I predict that time will catch up with him, and his worst nightmare will be someone with a little cell phone with video from his visits to the Dominican Republic.
Yeah, I just think that these guys just go up there and they know that all the stuff that they're talking about is bullshit. They know it. They know it upside down and sideways, and they still put that stuff up there and people believe it.
Well, it pays well, Larry. It pays well.
Well,
I've heard it said that it is an absolute fact that Sean Hannity does not, you know, the life support system for a haircut, does not believe 90% of the crap that he vomits into a TV camera every night. But you know what? The pay is great. It's like the old Groucho Marx joke that got picked up on by Woody Allen, where he says, "Doctor, my brother thinks he's a chicken." And the doctor says, "Well, why don't you tell him he's not a chicken?" And he says, "Well, I would, but we need the eggs. You know, Hannity needs the eggs."
Shit slingers make money. Truth tellers are paupers.
Yeah.
That would be the case.
Often been the case. I mean, I believe it was H.L. Mencken who said that no one has ever gone broke by underestimating the intelligence of the American public. But I think that applies to most, pretty much all publics, because people can be duped, but they, as Lincoln said, they will not be duped forever, at least not everyone.
Well,
yes, definitely.
Hey guys, I hate to cut this all off, but we're out of time.
Sergi, I'm sorry. It's okay. I'm sorry, Sergi. Okay.
So I guess we'll call it quits here. Thanks everybody for joining in. Even the ones of you who didn't say anything. It's been a wonderful group. Good evening. Good evening to Horzak, and thank you for getting us started this evening. Thank you very kindly. We pulled up even and got $25 into tomorrow's fundraising to keep us up with the month of July. So thank you, one and all. And you know, Moran Monday will be upon us sooner than we thought. Thanks everybody. Thanks to our all volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky and Texas Betsy moderating in the chat room. Thank you to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thank you to John Fox down in Australia, who is working like crazy these days, advancing the album that he plays on and the band he plays in. Di Pritchard, DaiPritchard, DiPritchard.com. If you want to hear the Di Pritchard bands and purchase the Di Pritchard bands, Killing Time album, it is a rockin' good time. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women at Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and AICACT.org. Have a happy Independence Day, a happy weekend, stay safe, maybe stay off the roads. It's kind of, you know, it's like New Year's Eve. It's kind of amateur hour with drunk people on the highways this time of year. And we'll be back for more on Monday. And again, thank you, one and all, for making this Conversation Radio possible. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.